Welcome to Brains Matter, the podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, just an ordinary guy. G'day everyone, and welcome to episode 86 of Brains Matter. A lot of us have seen shooting stars and they look quite fast, don't they? But they're nothing in comparison to hypervelocity stars. So what are hypervelocity stars? To find out more, I spoke to Dr. Ross Church at Monash University, who explained what they were. Today, I've got Dr. Ross Church, who is a postdoctoral researcher currently at Monash University, with me. Ross, could you tell me a little bit about yourself and your background?
Okay, so I come from England, as you can probably tell from my accent. I did my PhD on stellar evolution and stellar dynamics at Cambridge University, and then I spent a year in Sweden at Lund University before coming here to Monash. And I'm working at Monash, I'm working mostly on AGB stars, but also still doing some work on binary stars and stellar dynamics.
And for the listeners who don't know what AGB stars are, go back to episode 26 and 27, just look for John Latanzio in the search bar on the right-hand side of the web page. So today, Ross, you mentioned you're a bit of an expert in binary stars. We're actually going to talk about hypervelocity stars. You wrote a paper. The title of the paper is The Nature of Hypervelocity Stars as Inferred from the Galactic Trajectories. Now, I read through the paper, and effectively, from my perspective, and being a non-astrophysicist, it sounds like there's a whole bunch of stars going at, no pun intended, but astronomical speeds, yet they're still in our galaxy. So let's have a little bit of a chat about that. So to start with, what are hypervelocity stars?
The hypervelocity stars are basically the fastest stars in the galaxy. If you look at the galaxy, you see it forms basically a disk with spiral arms, and we're some way out along one of the spiral arms in the disk of the galaxy. Then towards the centre, there's a central bulge of stars. And then there's a diffuse halo of older red stars surrounding the galaxy. The hypervelocity stars kind of stand out in this like a sore thumb, because whereas most of the stars in the galaxy, and basically all the younger, bluer stars, are in the disk of the galaxy, the hypervelocity stars are above and below the disk.
So if we think about the galaxy as a plate, if you put a lump of mashed potato on that plate, the hypervelocity stars tend to be somewhere in that mashed potato rather than in the plate itself.
No, they're much further above. They're kind of hanging from the ceiling of the room.
Okay,
because
wow.
They've generally been flung out of the galaxy at very great speeds.
So what kind of speeds are we talking about? Yeah. So in comparison to a normal star, is it twice as fast? Is it?
So the stars in the galaxy are generally going at maybe a couple of hundred kilometres a second. Mm-hmm. The hypervelocity stars get up to a couple of thousand.
Wow. So in the order of 10 times as fast.
Yes. I mean, they're really very obviously wrong, if you see what I mean. They're very, very obviously different objects to the rest of the stars in the galaxy.
So it's kind of like watching the cars on the freeway and then a Formula One car goes past.
Yeah.
Except much faster.
Yeah.
So do we know what causes these hypervelocity stars to go at such speeds?
Of the things we have that accelerate stars, there are two basic possibilities. When a supernova goes off somewhere in a set of stars, then the resulting object will get a velocity kick. That mm-hmm. is, it will move off at a faster speed. So that's one possible way they could be formed. Mm-hmm. A second possibility is through some sort of interaction with a very massive, very dense object. And there's an obvious candidate for that, which is that there is... It's thought there's very good evidence that there's what's known as a supermassive black hole at the centre of the galaxy.
So most people assume that the majority of galaxies have a supermassive black hole at their centre.
Yeah, that's probably true, yeah. And these things are are of the order of millions to billions of times the mass of the Sun, the Sun being a fairly ordinary average mass star. The supermassive black hole at the very centre of our galaxy is about 5 million times the mass of the Sun.
Okay, wow. Don't get too close to that.
Well, indeed, yeah. And these things, it's thought that the hypervelocity stars form actually when they do get too close to the supermassive black hole, because what's thought happened is you somehow get a binary star, that's a pair of stars, have some sort of interaction with the supermassive black hole. And the reason you need a binary star for this to work is that very basic physical concept, the conservation of energy.
So the binary star, I'm assuming, would be rotating around a centre of gravity between the two objects.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And if, so this is just me thinking out loud, if they get too close to a supermassive black hole which has a huge amount of gravitational attraction, then does that mean it flings one of them off?
Yeah, so it captures one of them, and that one's very, very, then very tightly bound. You need a large amount of energy to extract that back, that star back to where it was previously. And that energy goes into the other star and accelerates it such that it's kicked out of the galaxy and forms one of these hypervelocity stars.
So if we had a normal star which wasn't in a binary, would that mean it would be accelerated but not nearly as much because it doesn't have that tight bound?
Yes, because you don't have this, you get quite a complicated interaction which leads to this pair of a tightly bound star and an ejected star. And for a single star, it would go rather quickly when it approached close to the black hole, assuming it wasn't swallowed by it. But it comes back out again at a given distance at the same speed that it came in at.
Just so conservation of momentum.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
How does the conservation of momentum relate to the binary star then? For people who aren't aware of the conservation of momentum, the laws of physics basically say that momentum, which is mass times velocity, doesn't change over time. It can be transferred, but the total amount doesn't change. Assuming the two stars in the binary system are equivalent in weight, and one gets flung out, does that mean that the one that gets flung out, it's got half the mass now, so it's got twice the velocity, or is there something a bit more complicated than that?
It's a bit trickier to try and think in terms of the momentum and where it goes. Partially because the black hole itself has such a large mass that just a very small change in its speed takes up a lot of momentum. It's actually easier for once to think about the energy. And effectively, the star that remains bound to the black hole in the centre has a very large negative energy. That is, it's captured very tightly. You'd have to put in a lot of energy to get it back out again. Whereas the hypervelocity star that's kicked out has a very large positive energy. It's escaping at a very large speed. What we looked at is some of these stars that are evicted from the they're evicted from the galaxy at very high speeds, but there's a range of speeds, depending basically on how close the binary gets to the black hole, or rather how close the star that's captured ends up. So you get a range of speeds of the hypervelocity stars, and some of them, they're still moving exceedingly fast, but the gravitational pull of the whole galaxy is sufficient that they will eventually come back again.
Okay. How long would that take? That's probably in the order of millions or billions of years, though, isn't it?
It's of the order of billions of years, the orbital time, yes.
So going back to that analogy we were talking about before, the plate and the mashed potato in the room and the ejected hypervelocity star being on the ceiling, that's quite a distance away. So given that it's coming back, is there the likelihood of that ejected star being attracted by another galaxy, for example?
No, because although it's a very large distance away compared to the size of the galaxy, the spacing between galaxies is, in general, rather large. There are some local galactic companions, the Magellanic Clouds and the Andromeda Galaxy, but the chances are that it would remain bound to our galaxy, most likely.
So that's a fair distance for gravity to operate across, yeah. Well, yes. Obviously gravity operates across the whole universe, but that's quite a distance, yeah, for it to come back to. So yeah, when it comes back, will it be going at the speeds that it was ejected at as well?
Yes, basically so, because that's pretty much the conservation of energy, that mm-hmm. its gravitational energy depends almost only on the distance away it is. There's mm-hmm. a bit about what angle it's moving at, but its gravitational energy is basically just on the distance from the centre of the galaxy. So at a given distance away, it will move at the same speed.
Mm-hmm.
So it will, they're currently zooming away at a great speed, they'll slow down towards the furthest away point of their orbit, and then they'll come back again, accelerating back towards this very high speed as they get to come back to the centre of the galaxy again.
Mm-hmm. So at the moment we're talking about ejected stars or ejected hypervelocity stars that tend to go, roughly speaking, perpendicular to the orbit of the galaxy. Are there ones that are ejected along the plane of the galaxy, so likely to hit other stars or...?
Yes, there's no particular reason why they should go in any particular direction.
Mm-hmm.
The main reason why we see them above the plane of the galaxy is that that's where they're easy to find,
mm-hmm.
Because there aren't any other blue stars above the plane of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of blue stars in the disk of the galaxy, and also there's all sorts of other stuff in the disk of the galaxy, big clouds of gas and dust, mm-hmm. which, and lots of other stars, which make it very hard to
observe them.
Yeah, to observe particular objects. But above the plane of the galaxy, there are no other bright blue objects.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like if you had talking about a cricket crowd or any sporting crowd, if you had someone out in the middle wearing the Australian or South African or English colours, you notice them, whereas if someone was wearing the same shirt in the crowd...
Exactly, yeah.
You don't notice them as much, even though they are there. So what about stars in the plane of the galaxy? We'll find out about that when we return to the interview. But right now, it's Listener of the Episode. Today's Listener of the Episode is Adrian Lee. Thanks for your support, Adrian, and I hope you're enjoying the show. Now, let's go back and find out about those hypervelocity stars. Does that also mean that the stars that are ejected somewhere along the plane of the galaxy are harder to find, not just because of the number of objects there are, but because they interact with other objects and they slow down so you don't notice their hypervelocity nature?
Probably not, actually, because other than right at the centre, the galaxy is a relatively uncrowded place.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the distance to the nearest star from the Sun is a few light years. Compared to how close you need to come to get a considerable interaction, which would be more like the distance, say, of the Earth from the Sun, it's very unlikely that this hypervelocity star, as it zings out through the plane of the galaxy, would come that close to another star. So it would probably pass out through the galaxy largely...
unscathed?
Yeah, largely unscathed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Given that there are hypervelocity stars ejected at all different directions, and you mentioned that there isn't much of a likelihood of an interaction with other objects, assuming that there was an interaction, what kind of impact would it make? So, for example, let's take doomsday scenario, and there's a hypervelocity star coming towards our Sun. What does that scenario mean?
Okay, so that would be pretty bad for us, because the star would most likely pass through the solar system at great speed, and the obvious effect would be to disrupt the orbits of the planets,
because
mm-hmm. it might knock the Sun out of position, it might even capture a planet as it went through. That's reasonably unlikely, and it might scatter them out of their orbits, kind of like Skittles in a bowling alley, effectively. Mm. And the solar system is actually quite a delicate thing in terms of the orbits of the planets. If you change the orbits of Jupiter by not necessarily a very large amount,
mm-hmm.
if you just took Jupiter as it stands today and leave it in the same position but slow it down by 10 or 20%, you actually find that over a large number of orbits, the solar system becomes completely unstable. And
breaks
the,
apart.
Yeah, it breaks apart. The planets, most of the planets get chucked out and lost from the solar system, or move on to very elliptical orbits where, and if the Earth was on such an orbit, it would be very cold for most of the time on the outer parts of the orbit and very hot on the inner parts. So actually the perturbation of the solar system by a very fast-moving star would be very serious for...
Well, let's hope there's nothing that comes our way.
But it's massively, relatively unlikely.
How many hypervelocity stars have you observed so far?
So we know of about 10 or 20 of them in total.
So is that indicative of a low number of these kind of interactions, or is that just a sample that you realise is just a small sample of a large number?
So there are two things here. I mean, to find these things, what the teams that have done the observations have done is looked across the sky out of the disk of the galaxy, so the sky above and below the galaxy, for bright blue objects. And they haven't yet surveyed the whole sky or followed up all the objects they've found. Because there is some confusion with fainter blue objects in the halo of the galaxy, the kind of...
The bulge.
Yeah. One of the great difficulties in astronomy is you can't tell easily whether an object is faint and relatively close to you, or bright and a lot further away. So having found all the blue things, you then need to measure their speeds, which you do using the Doppler effect. If things are moving towards you, that changes the frequency of light.
So they look more blue.
So things moving towards you look more blue, things moving away look more red. So you look for a spectral line produced by some element in the spectrum of the star, and you know what that frequency is.
You can observe what the shift is and work out how fast it's moving.
Yeah.
How often do you think one of these interactions happens? If, for example, we had an observational outpost somewhere near the supermassive black hole and galactic bulge, would we see these things? I guess in my mind I've got a Star Trek kind of mental image of these things going towards the supermassive black hole and then pinging away. Or is it just a once in a every few million or billion years that it happens?
So we can make a good estimate of it just by looking at the number of these hypervelocity stars we see, sort of the order of 10 or 20, and their lifetimes. And because they're rather massive stars, their lifetimes are closer to million years, tens of millions of years, rather than the 10 billion years of the sun's lifetime. So given there are a few tens of these things and their lifetimes are maybe the order of a few million years, we can say that they're produced maybe a handful every million years, say, as a rough estimate, which does make them pretty rare.
So what does that mean in terms of the evolution of the galaxy? Does it change it somewhat, or is it just one of those things that happen that doesn't really affect the rest of the galaxy?
For the rest of the galaxy itself, it's reasonably inconsequential. But for us, it's useful as a probe of lots of things, because it tells us something about the nature of stars that are falling towards the centre of the galaxy. What do these binaries look like? We know that there must be binaries containing high-mass stars falling in to the centre of the galaxy. We don't know yet exactly where they form, where they come from, how they get there sufficiently quickly that these stars, which have quite short lifetimes, are still blue and young when they reach the centre of the galaxy. And then the star that's left behind, the companion to this hypervelocity star, they're what have let us measure the mass of the supermassive black hole for the first time, because we see them on very tight elliptical orbits.
So are they left to remain orbiting the supermassive black hole?
Yeah. But because they're so close in, their orbits are very short, where in this context very short means tens of years. And they're actually short enough that we can...
Given the size of the supermassive black hole you mentioned before, tens of years is an extremely fast
Yes, absolutely, yes. And it's short enough that it means that we can have followed them around the whole of their orbit in
someone's lifetime.
In a research career's span of time.
The minor planet Pluto, for example, takes, 247 years? So it takes longer for that to orbit around the sun than this companion star to orbit around the supermassive black hole.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Well, that was fascinating to hear, Dr. Church. So if anyone has any questions, please send them through or leave a comment on the website and I'll forward them through to Ross for you. Thank you very much for your time today, and I'd love to have you back for another show in the future.
Thank you.
I hope you found that discussion interesting. I know I did. And yes, for those observant folks out there, I do realise that in hindsight that at one point I said weight instead of mass, so apologies for that. Now for some listener feedback. And a big welcome to the listeners of Citywide Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, USA, and particularly Robert Park, who's responsible for bringing Brains Matter to all the listeners out there. Eric Scaresbrook from Sydney wrote in and said, I know where you're coming from on the latest episode, fine leg to fine leg at the end of the over. I don't know why we just couldn't go from fine leg to mid on or off. I spent the first couple of balls recovering each other. So that was in response to the science and cricket episode. I know exactly what you're talking about, Eric. I used to feel it fine leg quite often. And a call out to listeners from Guatemala. Listener Anibal Ruiz wants to know how many of you are out there. Anyway, that's the end of today's show. I'll leave you with a quote from A.A. Milne. The third-rate mind is only happy when it's thinking with the majority. The second-rate mind is only happy when it's thinking with a minority. The first-rate mind is only happy when it's thinking. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right hand side. You can listen to the episodes from your browser by choosing Flash Player from the links and selecting whichever episode you want to hear from within the player. There's also other information on the site, such as links to articles and news, subscription details, both via iTunes and manually, and voting information. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email. All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now.